News, the Democrat-controlled House is moving ahead with two major immigration bills this week, which could create a pathway to citizenship for millions. The American Dream and Promise Act and the Farm Workforce Modernization Act would protect undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children and provide legal status to farm workers. These will be the first immigration reform measures taken up by Congress this year. Hundreds of people gathered to march through Louisville, Kentucky on Saturday, marking 1 year since plainclothes police officers busted through the door of Breonna Taylor's home in the middle of the night and shot her dead. Breonna Taylor was a black 26-year-old emergency medical technician and aspiring nurse. Her mother, Tamika Palmer, led the Louisville rally while chanting, "No justice, no peace." The death of Breonna Taylor is drawing increased attention to the use of no-knock warrants and police raids. Three states have since adopted Breonna's law, banning the practice, and major police departments in cities have also prohibited its use. But Kentucky, Breonna's home, has not yet banned no-knock warrants statewide. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 39 degrees under fair skies. In New York City, 30 degrees and sunny. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Stay tuned for Leonard Lopez at Large coming up. It is 1 minute past 1 p.m. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Leonard Lopez at Large. I'm Leonard Lopez. As the Biden administration begins the difficult task of bringing the country out of the health and economic crises of the last year, people have been looking at the difference between its use of language compared to the previous one. So we have invited our favorite language experts, the brother and sister team of Catherine and Ross Petras, back to our show. Their most recent book is Awkward, spelled A-W-K-W-O-R-D, Awkward Moments, A Lively Guide to the 100 Terms Smart People Should Know. And like their other books on language, that doesn't mean what you think it means and you're saying it wrong. It's published by 10 Speed Press. They also have a podcast called You're Saying It Wrong. If you have a question on word usage or pronunciation for Kathy and Ross, you can call us at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Or you can email your questions for them to me at leonardlopate@wbai.org. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Leonard. How you doing?
I'm okay. Leonard, how are you?
Okay. Glad to have you back.
Glad to be back.
In looking at your book, Awkward Moments, I see a few terms that seem especially relevant right now, like the German word Weltschmerz.
Indeed. I think we're all suffering from a great deal of Weltschmerz at this point.
World weariness, because the Germans couldn't have known about what was going to happen over the last year.
They anticipated well, right?
Well, a lot of people have developed weariness for lockdown, quarantine, social distancing, and other trappings of COVID-19. Are there even more specific terms for this particular kind of emotion, like quarantine fatigue or cabin fever?
Well, we mentioned a number of both German and French words, ennui, which is sort of a weariness I think we all have as well. There's an interesting word that comes from monks in the early Christian period called, and actually Greco-Roman period called axidia or axidia, which is sort of a noonday demon of like utter boredom at 12 o'clock. Well, I'm getting passionate about being down.
I've seen a German word, Corona-Müde. Does that mean COVID fatigue in German?
Yes, I think it does actually.
I believe it does. There was a whole lot. There's a group called the Leibniz Institute for the German Language. And they found that in Germany, over 1,200 coronavirus-related words were added to the language. I mean, my personal favorite, and I'm going to really screw up the pronunciation, is Spuckschutzschirm, a spit protection umbrella.
Wow. So the people are using umbrellas to protect themselves against the
spit going through. Well, I'm sure it also helps with social distancing. You could just sort of make it into a shield.
One German word that some people thought was recent, but it actually goes back to World War II, is Hamsterkauf, which is hamster. It's a German word, and it refers to people just hoarding stuff like a hamster. I think we had more Hamsterkauf in the early phases of COVID than now. I don't find myself hoarding anything. Toilet paper is in ready supply everywhere.
There have been a lot of articles on the very different speaking styles of President Biden and former President Trump. Biden's personal style is quieter, more unassuming. Does that also translate into his word usage?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, one thing that just came right off the bat was we're gone with illegal alien. That is no longer in official immigration parlance, apparently. They're trying to be more inclusive.
Yeah, three years ago.
Aliens are now going to be, pardon me?
I have a news report that said that 3 years ago, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions ordered officials in his department to use the term illegal alien in all communications when describing someone who didn't come to the United States through legal means. And in a memo, Justice Department officials wrote that the word undocumented is not based in U.S. code and should not be used to describe someone's illegal presence in this country. Of course, then the Biden team has reversed that policy and they prefer to non-citizen and undocumented immigrant.
And undocumented non-citizens. It's getting a little tongue twisted on that one. But yeah, well, I think that's actually a good sign. I think it's interesting.
It's fascinating, though, watching the evolution, because now I had read somewhere, I think it was in the Times, that said they're allowed to now say science-based evidence again. And apparently that was completely verboten in the Trump years. So you are seeing a distinct change, and it's overt, which I find fascinating. It's normally you just these things just sort of happen, but these are being like overtly and openly and in a codified way, which is pretty unusual and obviously necessary.
I thought it was really interesting with immigrants. Now they're not saying assimilate, which I remember as a kid always hearing the assimilation sort of thing of like America, the melting pot, assimilate. They're now saying the integration of immigrants into society, which is a different, it's interesting. Even that's a subtle change, but that's a big change.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that. I like that, though, because there's a real difference between the two. And you wouldn't think of assimilation as a loaded term, but there's a distinct difference. Yeah.
The years of the previous administration might be described by another German phrase that you write about in your book, Sturm und Drang.
That's something I think we're all exhausted with, too.
That means turmoil or storm and drama. Is that what it means?
Literally, yes. It's one of those words. It started out as a romantic phrase. It was in the name of a play, a German play, I think back in the later 1700s. And it became a term for a specific movement in German literature, which was like Britain's Angry Young Men, but it was the German precursor of it. And it was just very heavy on passion and angst and drama. And I think that's how I used to feel watching the COVID press conferences early on, as I recall.
Well, Jennifer Psaki, the Biden White House press secretary, said, quote, "The president has been clear to all of us. Words matter, tone matters, and civility matters." And she works for Biden, not for Cuomo, obviously.
Ooh, nice one there, Leonard. It's fascinating, though. Again, even with the Cuomo thing, I mean, you see the impact of words, and I think more than ever in recent years, we're really focusing on not just what is said, but the way in which it's said. And I think words are getting much more center stage these days.
They're kind of weaponized at this point.
They are
in a way they wouldn't have been 20 or 30 years ago, I think.
Last month, the deputy press secretary was forced to resign after using disrespectful language to a female reporter. So we're seeing a total change in the climate in the White House. And then
it's different.
And then again, there is the matter of climate. There are a number of words or phrases that the Trump administration refused to use, like climate change. Mm-hmm. Did they think that if we didn't use the term, it would lose importance?
I think so, in a certain way. I think that if you don't apply a widely used term that becomes part of like the normal vernacular, people tend to ignore it. What they would do, though, a lot was come up with a different phrase. It wasn't really like Orwellian newspeak as much it was – well, I guess it kind of was, wasn't it?
It was sort of war is peace. Yes, it's definitely well
in that sense. What did they say instead of climate change? I forget, but everything was like, became either twisted or ignored. Mm-hmm. It was a very strange time for words.
Mm-hmm. And now the EPA has begun using the hashtag climate crisis. So they're really signaling a totally different attitude.
Yeah, it's a sea change.
But in general, I think we're going to see more inclusive language, a better sort of more ecologically attuned language, and fewer attributions like the China virus. I think that's going to be over. I think we're going to call it COVID or coronavirus without the, possible origin of the virus in that sense.
Loaded words are heavens going down,
We'll get to a few more, but interestingly, the Biden White House has also restored a Spanish language version of its website, which was taken down by Trump.
And sign language is now used again. Sign language is often shown when they're doing a speech. That was not done with the Trump administration, to the best of my knowledge, too.
I've always wondered about sign language because sometimes I cannot figure out what that person is signaling with hands and face and whatever in any way represents what I've just heard. It is a totally different language, obviously.
it's funny. I mean, because when I was a kid, I remember being fascinated by sign language. And that was when you would learn, I think I did it in Girl Scouts. You'd learn the alphabet.
Yeah, we did that in Boy Scouts too.
Now it's the different signs. And I have the same thing, Leonard. It's as if I'm watching like French or somebody's talking French in the corner, for me, it's like, I have no idea what they're saying, but obviously it works. So. And it's an important addition if they didn't have it before, certainly.
We invite listener calls and listeners don't have to just talk about the things that we're discussing. They can call in any questions on word usage or pronunciation that they may have. Our number here is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Or you can email me at leonardlopate@wbai.org. Terms like we're starting to see other terms as well, terms like pro-choice, pro-life, other examples of how politics affects language rather than anti-abortion or pro-abortion rights.
It's true. Again, you go back to it felt like when Ross had the assimilation versus integration, how a simple choice of words can signal something overtly. You're saying, oh, this is just a word. This just means exactly that. But there's a distinct loaded nature or a judgment implied in a lot of terms now.
It's interesting because I saw just recently on a financial website that tends to lean right. They had a headline, and it said, Second Amendment activists gather to take away, to limit gun rights. Mm. That's like, you could also say pro-peace activists act to, cut back on automatic weapons. You could take it, you could frame it either way. The first way I saw it is instantly two negatives. Immediately you get a slight negative for Sean, even if you are for gun control. It's sort of interesting how you can frame things that way.
And you could confuse things by calling it pro-life.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah,
that's exactly.
That always fascinates me. Total aside, I'm going to go on a tangent, but have you both noticed that nowadays, we never used to say, we used to talk, I'm thinking COVID right now, with the vaccinations. We used to always talk about shots or inoculations, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Suddenly we've picked up the British word jabs. Did you notice that? Everybody's talking about jabs now.
I'm talking about jabs. Yeah, I know.
When did this happen? I mean, why jab? It just fascinates me.
It also just because I'm saying it now, but I don't remember when it came into my vernacular. I don't remember first. I would never have used it last year. I suddenly started saying it. I have no idea when I started. It's just there.
Well, maybe it makes it sound less scary. But all of these words that we're talking about, aren't we talking about the same process being used to different ends?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that again, we're using words to sort of sell or in a way our point of view. It's like some of them are positive, some of them are negative, and the choice I think is gives a different meaning in a funny way. Even if it means the exact same thing, it has a different weight.
I think that's right with.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think you're right with jab though. Because I was thinking vaccination sounds so clinical. Mm. The jab sounds casual, great, now I'm fine. I think that's probably
a little jab. Well, I've had it, and it barely was even a pinprick. So a lot of people ask, the people who haven't had it, was it a problem? It's not a problem, I guess, unless you have other issues. But anyway, let me tell everybody that my guests are Catherine and Ross Petras. They are regular contributors to our show. We talk about the language, and we invite your calls at 212-209-2877, or you can email me at leonardlopate@wbai.org. And let's take some calls, okay?
Absolutely.
Oh, first of all, I should tell people that they're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. The FCC insists that we say those things on a regular basis. Okay, BAI, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Oh, here, American Sign Language. You just reminded me, sign language. I happen to know a little, but just a little, because they do say ASL, American Sign Language, which means I know that grammatically it is not like they don't interpret word for word like a sentence. It's more, it's very idiomatic. I mean, in other words, it's not just here's sign language for English. It's different in America than in England. It's something worth researching because it is ASL, and it's like, so you could go to England and they may not understand you because the idiomatic gestures, they're like, anyway, something that worth looking at.
No surprise. I lived in England for a year. I went to art school when I was 20 years old, and they didn't understand me half the time either because I was speaking American English. I had to learn to stop saying the news.
I remember you told the joke that you're in art class and the woman asked you if you have a rubber. Here's what I'm going to ask.
That wasn't a joke. That was a reality.
Yeah. And here's something I just learned the other day, that the expression, the devil's in the details, it actually has a corollary, the opposite. It's like it was the God is in the details, meaning pay attention to the little things, which I love because it's like I love Keith Jarrett. It's like, no, it's that little, look at that subtle thing he does there. God is in the details, that little, or you could say a chef. Oh, but that it took on the opposite, I think is fascinating, that it also has the expression the devil's in the details for the negative aspect of that. Do you know anything about that idiom and how it took on God is in the details and devil's in the details?
I don't know offhand, but I'm fascinated by the fact of I love the notion of this, the change, which, I mean, we see that happen with words alone. Like they go through either pejoration when a word turns from a positive meaning to a negative, and the opposite, amelioration, when a word turns from a negative to a positive. But that specific phrase, I don't know about. Do you?
But I would think that the devil in the detail is beware of what you're listening to. It may sound okay, but when you check it out carefully, you're going to find out that there may be some serious problems.
Right. It's like The Americans with Disabilities Act sounds good to me. Now let's talk about the details. Oh, man, that's expensive. What? It could do more harm than good, you know. And but I like the idea of that there was an originally God is in the details. I mean, like, appreciate the subtleties. It's like if you went to the Michelangelo exhibition in the Metropolitan Museum. It's like yeah, we know it's a face, but it's like these even contemporary artists of the time, you know. But it's like, but there's something about it. What is it? What did he do? He put the God in the detail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting, though. No one really knows where it came from, though. I was just looking it up briefly, and there are some attributions to Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, a German architect, but that's not necessarily. Then the other people are saying, are attributing it to Flaubert, and they have it in French, which is interesting because in both cases, it's a very recent expression, God is in the detail, and then it switched to the devil, as we were talking about.
Yeah, but I would think it is a much older sense.
I would have thought it's from medieval times or something.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but the one problem always with language is it's really hard to trace the original origin of something. I mean, this is what these people are saying. Sure. We have no idea.
Let's take another call, okay? Thank you so much for your call. BAI, you're on the air.
Oh, Leonard and guests, I'm talking about England. I'm actually from there, from London.
I wouldn't have known from your accent.
Yeah, I was thinking Brooklyn.
That's right. Thank you. Well, I'll take that as a compliment in both directions, and I'm happy to still have my accent after 20-something years. But if I could be very quick and tell you about five words. The first word is normality, and I don't hear that on this side of the pond. I only hear normalcy.
Yes.
And the opposite, of course, is abnormality. I don't hear abnormalcy, so that's one. If you'd please comment after I just finished the five words, if that's okay.
Sure.
The second one is the A sound. I always said, growing up in England, Milan for the city in Italy, and I hear Milan. Because the A sound is pronounced not A, but R, majority of the times. And then the third one is trauma. I don't hear that at all. I hear trauma, like T-R-A-H-M-A, but it's traumatic. It's not traumatic. And the fourth one is N-E-W-S, the news. I only hear, and I shall not mention the name of the TV station, but they do pronounce news as news. Otherwise, I hear N-O-O-Z, or as we said in England, Z-E, news. And the last one is the last letter of the alphabet. I think this is the only country that says Z, and the rest of the world, including our northern neighbors, say Z. Just curious about those five.
Could I throw one more out to you, actually? How do you pronounce P-A-S-T-A?
Easter.
No, pasta or pasta?
Pasta or pasta.
Oh, pasta.
When we say pasta.
Okay. That's because of the A sound, as I mentioned in the word Milan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the R rather than A.
Yeah.
Yes, and what about my other examples of normality, et cetera?
Okay, well, normalcy is thought to be American. A president of ours, Warren Harding, gets credit for using it. He probably more popularized it because it was a very rare word until he came into the presidency. And he apparently had a penchant for chucking it around everywhere. And since then, it's, I would say, infected American English. I prefer normality.
But then you wouldn't say abnormalcy, would you?
No. And that's, again, the interesting sort of thing of how languages evolve. There's no real logic necessarily to language whatsoever. I don't think normalcy is a particularly nice word, so I don't like it. But.
trauma?
As opposed to trauma? I don't know. What's wrong with trauma?
I've got to admit, as an American, I say trauma. I say it like New York, to trauma. I do it with the A-W sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that a lot of it, the change in pronunciation, there was something, I'm trying to think, Ross, we both had seen that. Remember we were talking about the different pronunciation within even the regions, because you still have oddly enough, a lot of what is perceived of as an American regional accent is more British in many cases, more of a British pronunciation than an American, what we consider a regular American pronunciation.
Well, for example, we say there's Nevada and Nevada, there's Florida mm-hmm. and Florida, and we can go on and on and on, and it tells you where a person lives simply because of the way they pronounce a state that is, one of the 50.
But getting back to trauma, I was thinking not so much as the New York AW, but as the AU, as in trauma and traumatic, because I don't hear over here, correct me if I'm wrong, traumatic.
No, you don't. You're absolutely right.
I say traumatic. So,
and then news, N-E-W-S, pronouncing the E-W instead of the O-O.
People made fun of me when I said news, so I started saying news, and I started saying the dew is on the rose instead of the dew is on the rose. But there are
the news one fascinates me because I've got to admit, I obviously say news. I do the American thing, and I don't think in my ear I even think to hear. I can't do it the other way.
Leonard mentioned D-O and D-U-E. That's one thing that always gets on
D-E-W.
My...
D-E-W.
D-E-W. The Jew on the ground. And I went and, I do something. But they both sound the same.
Yeah.
Just curiously, how would you pronounce T-U-B-E?
Is that T as in Peter?
No, T-U-B.
T as in cube.
You're right. Yeah. The tube,
we say
like
tube.
The underground, the subway.
Yes.
Yes.
We say
the
tube.
Tube, yes. And, tube, and here you say tube, yeah. Isn't it?
And if someone didn't have any clothes on in the tube, what would they be?
They'd be nude.
We're getting a little salacious here.
On the other hand, we don't pronounce F-E-W foo. So... Go explain these things.
And the last letter of the alphabet, of course, is an anomaly. Only in this country would you say Z, but the rest of the world is. When you learn English, it would be Z, right?
Well, that fascinates me because Ross is a Canadian now. Ross moved to Toronto and has been there for quite a long time. And when he first started saying A to Z to me, I was taken aback. But, I mean, it's all they say there. So, of course, now he says Z. I still say
Z. But you know, so many letters have E's. And the B, C, we don't say said and bed. So, you know.
That's interesting. Never thought of it that way.
In fact, Z is the only one that ends with an ed.
Yes, well,
you know why that is?
That comes from the French.
No, the Z comes from, in Greek, and Kath and I are both Greek in background. It comes from the Greek zeta, which then came from the French. Zeta.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because we don't say bed, and the B came from beta. So.
Okay, well, I'm going to take another call. Thank you so much. That was a great call. BAI, you're on the air.
Hello,
you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. I want to say hello to your guest, Eric. How does one pronounce the word nihilism or nihilism? What's the correct pronunciation for that?
That's a good question, because we just addressed that in one of our recent podcasts. We talked about it, and I say nihilism.
Mm-hmm,
and
me too.
Ross says nihilism, and we're both right.
Like,
which makes life a lot simpler.
I always thought that nihilism was kind of Egyptian, so that's what I'm saying.
So
I'm in denial.
What would it be? The nihilism.
Nihilism, it could be either one.
But nihilism is usually the first pronunciation.
Really?
Nihilism, okay.
Nihilism,
annihilate.
Annihilate, exactly.
Yeah. Second, I'm curious to know, sometimes when you watch TV and there's this general, and he's involved in the war in Iraq or somewhere in the Middle East, and he says, it's existential. Now, I'm looking at this general in a uniform, and I'm saying, what is this guy know about existentialism. Is he incorrect in his? Why are they using that word? They're using that word a lot on TV. All the time pertaining to something like crime. They're thinking, it involves your body, you're gonna die if you don't kill a criminal or you don't kill an Iraqi guy. So I mean, but like really, existentialism pertains to existential choice, which is since there is no God, you have to make your choices.
Yeah. There's a philosophy.
So what would it be?
Okay,
what do you think?
In his
use of the word?
Well, at its most basic, existentialism simply means exactly what it sounds like. It means of or pertaining to existence. Existentialism as a philosophy is taking that word and applying it to a philosophical school of thought. So technically, the guy, the soldier, the general that's standing there in his khakis or whatever, saying something's existential is probably correct. And he's not probably speaking in the philosophical sense. He's saying it's an existential threat. We could die. Our existence could cease.
Oh, okay. All right.
So how do you pronounce the philosopher? Sartre or Sartre?
Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre. Yeah.
Yeah, but I would say Sartre. Yes. Okay. Anyway,
number three. This is my final question. I was reading a Vanity Fair magazine, and they were saying, like some person is prejudiced against people whose appearance, it's not. Whose appearance is unattractive, so I forgot what that word, what that word was. So I asked the librarian. The librarian said lookism, but maybe that's not it. I don't think that's
lookism.
I can't find that that magazine. But do you know what the word? If there's a word for people who are prejudiced or don't like. Unattractive.
The librarian's right. Lookism is a fairly new word, and it describes when people are discriminated, people who discriminate against others who they consider unattractive. It's one of those neologisms that has come about when we add an ism to something, and lookism is definitely a term now.
Oh, so I can use that. I can use that. Okay.
Yeah, you can.
It's like a fancy term. From the magazine, so you don't know what that word is.
Well, we'll take a little break and think about it, okay? Because I got to take a break now.
Okay.
Thank you for your call. And we invite more calls. Our number is 212-209-2877, or you can write to me at leonardlopate@wbai.org. This is WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at wbai.org.
I say either, you say neither, and I say neither, either, and either, neither, let's call the whole thing off. Yes, you like potato, and I like potato, you like tomato, and I like tomato, potato, potato, tomato, tomato, let's call the whole thing off.
And we're back with Catherine and Ross Petras. They've written a number of books on language, Awkward Moments, A Lively Guide to the 100 Terms Smart People Should Know, Awkward spelt with a W-O-R-D instead of W-A-R-D. And then they also have written That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means, and You're Saying It Wrong, all published by 10 Speed Press. They have a podcast called You're Saying It Wrong. And I've always loved that song. And I was reminded of our British caller when he said tomato, tomato. But I've never heard anybody say potato. Have you?
No.
No.
And you know, in the song, they also say banana, banana, and I don't think I've ever heard banana.
I never heard banana either. Although yeah, we had a friend who used to sing that song, and he would sing it as, I say tomato, and you say tomato. And people would sort of, people would stop and look at him and correct him. It was great.
Well, potato, definitely. Yeah, I've never heard anybody say potato. Getting back to the theme, well, first of all, again, an invitation, if you want to give us a call and join the conversation, the number 212-209-2877, or you can write to me, send me an email at leonardlopate@wbai.org. A lot of other phrases have been changing recently. Were to describe the indigenous peoples of this country, have become really politically charged. I read recently that the term tribal with a capital T is now preferred over Native American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so much. I mean, then we go back to like the change with pronouns. I mean, we've just really been seeing quite a change, I think, with the introduction of the, singular they, capitalization of black. There's a big change happening.
That's all the gender equality thing. We have many of us have received emails in which the sender's name is followed by the words he/him/his mm-hmm. or she/her/hers or even they/their/theirs. Mm-hmm. It's become very important to many people.
Well, again, I think we go back to the power that words have. I mean, we use words every day. We use them without thinking, but they're incredibly powerful. And I think, like, the whole notion with the pronoun in particular is becoming, it's again, an inclusion and I think an acceptance, a sign of acceptance and a sign of the attempt, at least, to broaden, I think, overtly broaden our acceptances. And make things normal. Again, we go back to codification, which I think is a key.
So I guess people don't want to be pigeonholed.
Yeah.
But it gets confusing to me. Okay, go ahead.
We're in a flux, though, too. I think what happens when language doesn't seem to change in a gradual way in many cases, there's suddenly like a tidal wave of change. Mm. And I think right now we're getting slapped by the wave and we're trying to figure out what's what. Kathy and I wrote a book a couple of years ago on sort of a popular history book that's now in editing. And we noticed that over the past year and a half, some references we made had to be somewhat altered because this word is out or this word is the preferred usage. Like you were talking about Native American with indigenous. Canada was easier where they call them First Nations, which I think is a really good phrase. First Nations here. And I think that I like how that sounds.
Why do you think we haven't picked that up?
Because no one ever listens to Canadian South of the border.
Because they say a boat.
One thing Ross and I were talking about, this is completely off topic, but Leonard, we were saying how we realized we're a bit pedantic. We've been going insane the last 2 days when people were talking about daylight savings time.
Instead of daylight saving time?
Yes. Very good, Leonard. Yes.
We love you.
Yes. Savings. Yes. The savings are what we keep in the bank.
Correct.
Yes.
Now, before we get to some more calls, and we have some people hanging on, I do want to point out that the Washington Redskins and the Cleveland Indians are changing their names again because of changing attitudes. Interestingly, President Biden, when he says he's going to consult people, he says the American people, the territories, and the tribes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a big change.
You can't imagine Donald Trump saying any of that. But what about the word Yankees? Is that still a positive word? That's a Mets fan, so I don't care.
I never thought of that, though. Mm. I'm still fascinated with the Washington, with the Redskins now being the Washington football team, and I'm wondering if they're going to use that as their name.
Yeah, they can't come up with a name because so many of the good names are taken.
Yeah. I mean, they can't be the Washington bureaucrats.
Or the Washington feds.
Yeah, right.
Okay, to another German word you discuss in your book is Realpolitik. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's how I pronounce it. Okay. Yes.
Is a kind of politics based on practical concerns rather than idealism?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So it describes the decisions by politicians who vote with concern because they're more concerned about getting reelected than what they might be best for the country.
That would be realpolitik. Although theoretically, we talk about it in the book, and the problem with it, as soon as you get into these philosophical ones, you get stuck in the mud. Because one of the people one of the coiners of realpolitik was actually sort of an idealistic fellow, and he thought that true realpolitik should involve practically taking in ideals, which is just, it gets really complicated. The key thing now is it tends to be people who basically consider what's going on right now without worrying about ideology or ethical concerns.
With certain politicians, I'm not going to mention it, they get accused of that a lot.
Kissinger was famous for being supposedly a realpolitiker.
Yeah, well, there is a mansion in the sky. Anyway, should we take some more calls? Sorry, that was a really bad pun, wasn't it?
Yes, I know. I just caught it. No. There was a dead silence.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, is that me?
You.
Hi. The two words that I wanted to ask about are free and freedom. Free, of course, means unchained, unbonded, uncharged for, so forth and so on. And the usage would be you're free to say anything you'd like, you're free to print anything you like. But then freedom, the suffix D-O-M, as in with kingdom or earldom, refers to a structure of society. So in reality, when the libertarians are saying, we demand the freedom to carry guns and the freedom to speak, they're saying they want to be free to do those things. The freedom to carry a gun is specifically to have a militia to defend your country.
When was the last time we had a militia to defend our country? What was that?
About 1772.
Maybe 1812?
Oh, there were muskets rather than assault weapons.
1812? Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we're still...
The Constitution does say we're not allowed to have a standing army, so under those grounds, I guess we'd have to have militia. But, yeah. You know, just the freedom to speak is more consistent with the idea that everyone in the United States should be able to use the post office, exchange their ideas, and come to an E Pluribus Unum than it is the right of just me to stand on a street corner saying anything I want.
Yeah. Well, actually, the First Amendment only applies to Congress preventing us from saying things. Congress shall enact no laws. So,
but you know, that concept, we now normally use the word freedom as an individual thing when the actual suffix of D-O-M means societal.
Well, I'm thinking about Bobby McGee. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Could I just chuck in one thing, though? The D-O-M actually can also it comes from the Old English. It can also mean denoting a state or condition or denoting rank, like an earldom.
Kingdom. And,
but the dom can also just mean a state. So the D-O-M in this case could mean a state of being free.
They can't be separated. The being of an earl means you also had entitled lands and you were in charge of it and you had the structure of all of the lower ranks of aristocracy and you had its obligations to the king. So you couldn't really separate out the individual role from...
But we can't expect consistency, otherwise we wouldn't have the word condom. Let's let's move on to another call.
The state of being calm.
Conned, yes. BAI, you're on the air.
Hi. I love the discussions of language, and I didn't get much of it today, and I've caught you guys in the past. But I know that sometimes when I would travel places, people would detect where I came from. And I always was, in a way, critical of other people's grammar, and I see that that's very classist, and I always wanted to know the origins, the etymology in the correct way, and I listen carefully to newscasters. But then I realized we don't speak the King's English, and it changed. I grew up saying the word that heats the house, that actually radiates the house. I grew up saying radiator. Mm. And never saw anything wrong with it, never was corrected. And so my daughter was in high school, and one of her snobby friends said, why do you say radiator? It radiates heat. Yes. And made me...
We don't say nuclear radiation.
Right. So I felt very silly, but then I really feel dejected by that, because that was my way. And it was my neighbor. I put it out on a Facebook group that of people from the neighborhood. And, of course, only like 2 out of 10 said it my way. But it's something I grew up with in the way I don't want to part with. It doesn't make sense. And she said, oh, the state, O-R-E-G-O-N, is not Oregon, as I was. It's Oregon, because you have to pronounce it the way the people who live there pronounce it. So I think that language is fluid, and I don't think we should be quick to down someone. But I did feel silly saying the radiator is the radiator, but my whole family, everyone I knew said it. So
it's interesting you're talking about this, though, because there was a big kerfuffle about that a while back. And our father was from Astoria, Queens. Uh-huh. And in Astoria, the standard pronunciation was, as you said it, radiator.
Oh, great.
And then outside of New York, it seems to be more common to say radiator. Right. However,
Pennsylvania.
A bunch of, yes, Kathy's right.
I knew that one. Radiator is really common in Pennsylvania.
As well. So you're not alone.
Radiator? Yeah. If you're in Philadelphia, they'll talk about a radiator.
Radiator is in Philadelphia and Queens. Good. You've got a lot of company.
Oh, anyway, you're listening to us on the radio. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. We are talking about language with Catherine and Ross Petras, who are the authors of a number of books on language, Awkward Moments, a lively guide to the 100 terms smart people should know. That doesn't mean what you think it means, and you're saying it wrong, all published by 10 Speed Press, and they have a podcast also called You're Saying It Wrong. And before we get to another call, a listener wrote this one in. Do you happen to know the origins of the word pet? Did the verb pet, as in to pet, come from this word? Or is it the other way around?
That's a great question, because that's one of those ones where you do go a little crazy, you know, when there's both a noun and a verb.
It's actually, I think it came from, when I think about it, I think it came from, it's originally peta, I think is Gaelic or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was very early. Then the noun was there first. Then it's chicken or the egg. In this case, the animal was there first, and then the verb meaning to stroke something, they think, came from the 1600s, I believe. Mm-hmm. So that's much later. So the first thing was the noun, the animal. The second thing was doing it to it.
I thought it was Scottish Gaelic. I'm not
Scottish
sure.
Scottish Gaelic, yeah. It's pieta or something. Pieta, I can't pronounce it. Mm. And then Irish peta, which meant a tame animal. And then from there, from the 1600s, you actually petted your animals, and then it became that.
And now we have PETA. The last word in your book, Zeitgeist, The Spirit of the Time, I was thinking about it as it applies to the spirit of the past years and the present. It depends on whether you support an administration's policies. For example, the Biden administration's policies can either be hopeful and helpful or socialist and radical, depending on the spirit of the time.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that is not at all actually a loaded word. I think people tend to think of zeitgeist as sort of more positive, just because often when you're using it, you're referring to like that wonderful spirit. But yeah, zeitgeist is completely non-judgmental. It's just what's going on.
So let's take go ahead.
No, so it's like, yeah, it could go either way. That's all. I had nothing else to say.
Should we take another call? BAI, you're on the air.
Hello, are you speaking to me?
Yes, you.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. I want to go back and combine two things that you were talking about. You were talking about radiator versus radiator and do versus do and so forth. And it seems to me that English, as spoken in America, is such a contextual language that it really, the actual pronunciation by any single person doesn't really mean a lot, because you have to have it in context. Because I grew up in Texas, and my grandmother...
You escaped, right?
What?
You escaped?
No, I didn't escape.
Don't tell that to a Texan.
I think, you know, everything is perfectly fine, depending on where you are and what you like. And I was just as proud to be a Texan as I am proud to live in New Jersey. Uh-huh. But my grandmother used to do the wash, you know, the W-O-R-S-H, when she did the clothes. And when I moved north as a kid and used that word, or used the y'all or things like that, it was like, oh, you know, you don't know how to say these things. And it's all right. And it just, we have so large a country with so many different pronunciations, yeah, given the accent, that it to say wash in Texas for when I was a kid would have been what? What is? Oh, you mean the wash, George?
Yeah.
Well, look, if you had said Yosemite to the previous president, he would have said, what? Do you mean Yosemite?
Yosemite.
But it just seems to me that we are such a contextual language that you can really say whatever you mean, and poor people from other countries who don't speak English, they get thrown into a, you know, what are you talking about? Because
don't we also judge people based on their accents? For example, I always giggle when I see the senator from Mississippi, I think John Kennedy. His accent is so thick, it makes him sound, to some, a northerner like me with a lot of prejudices, it makes him sound stupid. I don't know whether he's stupid or not, but the point is that accent, to some degree, also is a way that we identify people.
I think you're absolutely right.
For better or for worse. I mean, there are problems with that, obviously. I remember when I was in the Foreign Service, there was one of the most intelligent persons I ever met. He had a very broad Southern accent, and he was trying to get rid of it he was concerned about it.
He felt people were judging him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unjustly.
Yeah.
A lot of people do feel that you're stupid if you have a Southern accent, and it's really not true.
No.
Well, in some cases,
it is. She had a Southern accent, so I would definitely agree. She was a smart lady. I agree with you.
We got to leave it there, unfortunately. It's always so much fun having the two of you on our show, Catherine Petras and Ross Petras, authors of a number of books on language. And I look forward to the next visit to our show.
Because you're more both... puns.
I think you should write a pun book, Leonard. I really do.
I know, it's terrible that my mind works that way. Thank you again, and we'll see you soon.
Okay.
And that brings us to the end of our show. Special thanks to segment producer Barbara Kahn for preparing today's questions. If you're new to our program and would like to hear more, you can access all of our past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as a podcast in iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere else that podcasts are available. And there are links to all of our past shows on our website, LeonardLopateAtLarge.com. If you want to comment on any of our shows or just want to say hello, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. Before I sign off today, I'd like to take just a minute to ask you to support WBAI. We're hoping that all of our listeners who have the finances to do so will step up and make a tax-deductible contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by going to give2wbai.org or by calling 516-620-3602 right now to keep the unique in-depth content that we bring you on the show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. And we need your help to keep this historic station the only one in the New York radio dial that's 100% listener-sponsored on the air. All you have to do is call 516-620-3602 or go to give2wbai.org to keep Leonard Lopate at Large coming to you on WBAI weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. From all of us at the station to everyone who has contributed so far, thanks, and I hope you'll join them. And we hope that you'll join us again tomorrow when Drs. Michael Okon and Ray Dorsey will discuss their new book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. We'll see you then.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. Federal authorities have arrested and charged two men with assaulting U.S. Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick with bear spray during the January 6th Capitol riot, but have not determined whether the exposure caused his death. Julian Eli Kiter of Pennsylvania and George Pierre Tanyos of Morgantown, West Virginia, were arrested Sunday and are expected to appear in federal court today. Direct payments from the newly approved coronavirus relief package began landing in people's bank accounts this weekend. But for some, the deposit could be significantly smaller than the promised $1,400 or may not arrive at all. Any private debt collector that has a judgment can garnish the latest round of payments. Credit card and medical debt are the two most likely to be collected by debtors. Stimulus checks may also be garnished by debt collectors for unpaid private student loans in some circumstances. The reconciliation process used by Democrats to pass the relief bill prevented Congress from including a provision to protect stimulus checks from being seized by private debt collectors. The House is moving ahead with two major immigration bills this week, which could create a pathway to citizenship for millions. The American Dream and Promise Act and the Farm Workforce Modernization Act would protect undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children and provide legal status to farm workers. These will be the first immigration reform measures taken up by Congress this year. Hundreds of people gathered to march through Louisville, Kentucky on Saturday, marking 1 year since plainclothes police officers broke through the door of Breonna Taylor's home in the middle of the night and shot her dead. Breonna Taylor was a black 26-year-old emergency medical technician and aspiring nurse. Her mother, Tamika Palmer, led the Louisville rally, marching behind a large banner with an illustration of Taylor's face while chanting, "No justice, no peace." The death of Breonna Taylor 1 year ago drew increased attention to the use of no-knock warrants and police raids. Three states have adopted Breonna's law, banning the practice, and major police departments and cities have prohibited its use. But Kentucky, Breonna's home, has not yet banned no-knock warrants. The Biden administration has instructed the Federal Emergency Management Agency to help process the increasing number of unaccompanied migrant children arriving in the U.S. As of this weekend, some 4,200 children were being detained in overcrowded Border Patrol facilities, where some of them have reportedly been held for a week or longer, forced to sleep on the floor, unable to shower, and were not allowed to call their families to alert them of their whereabouts. Over the last week, an average of 2.2 million vaccine doses were administered each day in the United States, a 9% increase from the week prior, according to the Washington Post. Racial disparities in vaccination rates are persisting, with 13% of white people at least partially inoculated, compared to just 9% of Asian people, 7% of black people, and 7% of Hispanic people, according to the CDC. Washington, D.C. has administered at least one dose to more than 108,000 people, with over half that group fully vaccinated. Maryland and Virginia have administered well over 1 million first doses each, while New York State has administered over 3.8 million first doses. Currently in Washington, it's partly cloudy and